Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're also welcome back to our show, one of our group of regular guests, folks who show up here every month. Guest today, David Sinnott. He's president and CEO of Strategic Capital Bank, and he is here with us to talk about investing, money management, and usually has a few things to say here to start out. He says he'll be talking a little bit about the stock market, and then after that, if you have questions about that or anything else that comes under the heading of personal finance, you're certainly welcome to call. So we'll get things underway by saying good morning and welcome back.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to spend a few brief minutes visiting with you and our audience about a very volatile and unsettling stock market. Obviously, stock market pain and stock market gyrations are evident everywhere. And let me give you just, well, three examples this year of stocks with really household names that have, in my opinion, caused, well, severe pain. Let's take AT&T, for example. Now, that's a stock that's always been considered a bellwether stock. It always was referred to as a stock for widows and orphans. That's how safe that stock was always treated, especially with its dividend yield. And its 52-week high was 61. The stock is currently trading around 20. That's a two-thirds drop in shareholder value for people who hold AT&T. How about Procter & Gamble? Now, that's surely a household name. All of us use some of their products. The 12-month high on Procter & Gamble was about $119 a share, and the 12-month low was $52 per share, a drop of more than 50%. Currently, the stock is trading in the high 60s to low 70s, still a 45% drop from its previous highs. And what about that NASDAQ, that so-called stock market of the world, that stock market of the future, where all the high-tech plays are in evidence? Well, blood is everywhere in the NASDAQ, including, for example, Microsoft. The 12-month high was $120 per share, and the 12-month low was $48 a share. That's an approximate 60% drop in value. Again, the stock has recovered a bit, and it's now currently trading in the $70 range. And finally, one of my all-time favorites, Priceline.com. Now, that's what I would refer to as a full-blown investor nightmare. And just last night, after the evening television news, when I think they're still counting votes and commentators, William Shatner, the spokesman for Priceline, was exhorting me to visit Priceline.com, purchase some plane tickets, hotel tickets, I think automobiles, gasoline, you name it. I'm supposed to purchase it or bid on it at Priceline.com so I can get away from my dream vacation. 12-month high on the stock, how about this one, $104 a share. Current price, $3. The math on this stock is pretty darn simple. A 97% decline, a 97% disaster, a 97% debacle. Now, let's talk plainly about stocks and utilize some historical perspective. First, volatility. Or large price swings, now the fancy name is volatility, let's call it large price swings, is not a recent or new phenomenon. Second, during any year, if we take a look at it from an historical perspective, it is perfectly normal, and in fact, it is an expectation that stocks will move in a trading range of at least 20% from their highs to their lows. In fact, the 20% trading range from highs to lows is more the rule than the exception. And third, because of extreme price volatility as experienced this year, owning an index or owning an asset class will likely reduce these extremes and reduce your paper losses, and note I refer to them as paper losses, in down years. For example, more than 50% of the stocks that comprise the S&P 500 index have suffered losses of 30% or more. Most of them, frankly, are 40% or more. Yet the S&P 500 index through yesterday's close, if you just simply own the weighted index, it's down only 6.5% for the year. That's a lot more comfortable than 40, 45, or 50%. Additionally, in very difficult stock markets, there are always certain asset classes or indexes which shine. For example, small company indexes and mutual funds which buy the smallest stocks in the Russell 2000 are enjoying gains of 2 to 10% this year. in spite of what's happening in the rest of the market. Real estate investment trust indexes, those are referred to as REITs, are still up over 20% for the year as an asset class. Obviously, it pays to be effectively diversified, to be well represented in these asset classes. Now, something else to remember. Stock market investing is still very much counterintuitive. Everybody loves to buy stocks, talk about stocks, when the market is moving up and stocks are expensive. Everybody's happy. The cocktail talk is, what stock did I buy? How much money did I make? But most of us hate the market when stocks are moving down and shares of great companies are cheap. Everybody says, oh, I don't want that company. The stock market's terrible. I better run over to the treasury market and buy some treasuries or CDs. And when stocks are moving down and shares are significantly cheaper than they were in the past, that's precisely the time that we should load up on shares of great companies or indexes. That is, that when companies or indexes are selling at what I refer to as fire sale prices. As a further example, many people feel as though they missed the great run-up in the NASDAQ, the Microsofts, the Oracles, the Ciscos. Well, folks, all those gains that were earned this year and really over the last 12 months in the NASDAQ 100 have been erased, and the index can easily be purchased now. It's actually 25% cheaper today than it was on January 1. Now, I might not be a mogul or a Philadelphia lawyer, even a hotshot money manager, but I do know one thing. If I can buy something 25% cheaper than it used to be, I feel a lot more comfortable about buying it now than when I was paying 25 or 50% more for that asset. Remember, the astute investor is in the share accumulation business. The shareholder who accumulates the most shares at the end of the game is going to be declared the winner. Now, that might not be the case with votes. That may work somehow differently, but that, I think, is David Inge's area and not my area. But remember, we're in the share accumulation business when it comes to investing. And when shares are cheap, it's a lot easier to load up and buy more shares. Now, there seem to be several factors which, in my view, is accounting for the recent performance of the market. First of all, it's no secret that corporate profits are slowing, and that is indeed a very real concern for investors, because ultimately companies have got to make some money. Companies have got to pay some dividends. Companies have got to show some substantial earnings or at least earning increases so people will be drawn to those stocks. And it's pretty clear from the most recent reports that are coming out, you don't have to look any further than the Wall Street Journal today to see that many companies are suggesting in advance of December 31 numbers that earnings are slowing and are going to be worse than earlier predictions. For example, Daimler-Benz and Chrysler today had a lot of lead articles about slowing profits at Chrysler, people being removed, thrown out of office, all kinds of shenanigans going on there. Second, many investors fear an even further erosion of corporate profits as our economy is slowing down. Look, we were growing earlier in the year at about a 4.5% rate. That was the annual growth rate. That's a pretty substantial rate. The most recent numbers are suggesting that that's been at least halved and that we're growing now at approximately a 2% rate, if that, as of September 30th. Corporate America is now concerned about the R word, about a potential recession. And recessions are not generally good, especially as you're going into them. If you can figure out when we're coming out of them, that's when the stock market really booms. Thirdly, on Wednesday of this week, Alan Greenspan's comments were still very tough and really gave very little hope in the short run for an easing of interest rates to spur consumer spending. And already retailers are beginning to worry a whole lot as we approach the holiday season. And consumer confidence continues to ebb and grow weaker. That's not a good thing when our economy, our GNP, is driven, at least two-thirds of it, by how many dollars we seem to spend in the catalogs and over the internet and all of those fancy stores for all of those products that you and I need, or at least my daughter, who is now a freshman at the University of Illinois, claims that she needs. But in any event, I guess she needs some of those things. Fourth, There's no question that higher oil prices have had some impact. But almost all of the statistical studies that have been done to date show that even with the kind of oil prices that we have, even with the anticipated higher heating prices, that may add at maximum 0.5% to our overall inflation rate. Greenspan's still worried about inflation. If he's worried about inflation, it's very difficult for him to lower interest rates, the Fed funds rate, and allow more dollars and allow more consumer spending. Still fighting inflation. And a tight labor market. We still have a very tight labor market, especially where we need high-tech and talented, educated people. And that market stays tight. And there is no question that corporations are paying more money for these people, and that ultimately has to be somewhat of a drag on corporate profits, especially in the case where productivity gains are slowing. Up to now, higher expenses, higher labor costs have been more than offset by tremendous productivity gains in this technological area, especially as a result, I think, of Y2K and all of the billions, if not trillions, of dollars spent in anticipation of that. Huge productivity gains actually took place as a result of all of that spending. But now it appears that productivity is slowing a bit. We've got higher oil prices. We've got a tight labor market. All of these things could be a drag, if you will, on corporate profits. That means stocks are unhappy. They may stay squeaky and unhappy. And finally, to some degree, and I really think it's to a lesser degree, uncertainty as to who in the world's going to be on Pennsylvania Avenue in January, well, that probably is having some effect. But I really don't believe it's the kind of effect that the other economic circumstances are having. But in spite of all of this weighty news, remember, stock market investing is a long-term commitment. If we think of it in periods of 20 years or more, a well-diversified stock portfolio in any consecutive 20-year period of time outperformed the most astute investor in fixed income. You could put all your money in CDs, all of your money in treasuries, and you can't find a 20-year consecutive period in American financial history where such a portfolio would have outperformed an effectively diversified portfolio of stocks and mutual funds. Markets move inherently higher. I don't know the direction of the next 1,000 Dow points, the next 2,000 Dow points. And frankly, I don't care a whole lot because I'm a long-term investor. But I know that the next direction of the next 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 points, and that's higher. And I truly believe when companies are on sale, and there's a lot of companies on sale, there's a lot of mutual funds and indexes on sale, it's not a bad time to back up the pickup truck and put a little load in the back of that pickup truck and mine a few more shares. I can only tell you that that's what I'm doing personally. That's what I'm doing for our clients. We bought Thursday. We bought Friday. We're buying today. And we'll continue to selectively buy, especially in areas that we think are undervalued. So there you have it, David. Just a little bit of history on the stock market and a little bit of what I think is just good old-fashioned common sense.
All right. Our guest this morning, David Sinnoh. He's president, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank, and he is on the program once a month on a Friday, and we do this show about money management. If you have questions about investing in financial planning, whatever it is that you're thinking about, whether that is your retirement, it is sending your children to college, whatever your financial goals are, I know that if you call in and ask questions, Dave will give you his advice. And then, of course, you might want to go out and seek out other advices, but we want you to be careful. If you want to call and talk with him, you can do that. 333-9455. That's for here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I'm sure, as we have discussed before, one of the best avenues, maybe the best avenue for most investors if they want to buy stocks is mutual funds so that they can have the appropriate diversity. Because as given the examples that you gave of how volatile individual stocks are, you want to spread that out so you spread out your risk. Okay, so There are, though, a number of ways that you can do this. There would have been a time when maybe the one of the easiest and best things you could have done was buy, say, the S&P 500. Of course, I'm assuming that AT&T, Procter & Gamble, and Microsoft are there.
Imagine that.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe buying maybe the biggest companies, maybe that's not the best strategy.
Well, interestingly enough, it's one strategy, and everyone should have some exposure to the S&P 500. But it's only one asset class, and there are 10 or 15 other asset classes. If you're going to have the largest companies in the world, you need to have the smallest companies in the world. For example, people don't realize this, but over the last 2 years, smaller companies have far outperformed large companies. The 3 years before that, it was S&P, S&P, S&P. 3 years ago, who had heard of the NASDAQ? Anybody even talking about the NASDAQ? Well, the NASDAQ 100, the 100 biggest companies on the NASDAQ, really are an asset class all to themselves. So the point is one has to be effectively diversified, look at all of these different asset classes, and once you look at all of the asset classes, you can see, am I underrepresented in one particular asset class? Is that an expensive asset class? And if it is not, is this an appropriate time to add to my position in that particular area, whether it's U.S. large, U.S. small, international, whether it's technology? All of these different areas need to be represented in some senses in your portfolio.
Well, you could now go out and buy something that, something like a total market index, which means you're essentially, I'm not quite sure how they do this, but essentially you're investing in everything. Now, are there advantages when you set that next to looking at various sectors and essentially doing the same thing but being in different funds?
Okay. There's something very important to understand. When you buy a total market index, which really sort of mirrors the Wilshire 5000, the Wilshire 5000 now is really made up of about 9,600 companies that call the United States their home. So when you're buying the total market index, you have a weighted average of those 9,600 companies. The problem is because it is a weighted average, your dollar that you are putting in that index is heavily weighted into the S&P 500, the biggest of the big companies. Mm-hmm. So the truth of the matter is that for every dollar you put in a total market index, probably 90% plus is just in the S&P 500 because those companies are so much larger than all the others. So it is one strategy with a portion of your money. But by utilizing just the total market index, you are not getting the additional exposure and the weightings that are so important in small companies, in the Russell 2000, in the 9th and 10th decile, for example, of the New York Stock Exchange. So you're really shortchanging yourself because when you compare the total market index to the S&P 500, it's really difficult to tell the difference when you compare the risks and the returns.
All right. We have callers, and we'd welcome questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we will start with a caller in Urbana, and this would be line number one. Hello? Caller there, line one?
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
My daughter is a teenager. She received a gift of General Electric stock recently. She's going to establish a Roth IRA with a portion of the gift. Should she sell some of the stock and incur the capital gains tax and start her IRA with a stock index fund, or just have an IRA composed of GE shares?
Well, now we have to be a little bit careful here because she received the GE shares as a gift. Is that correct?
Yes.
And do the GE shares have a pretty low stock basis?
I expect so.
Okay, because was this a gift from a relative?
Yes.
Okay, the rule is that if she received it from a relative, her basis is either the basis that the relative had in the stock or the price of the stock on the day it was gifted, whichever is lower.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that the basis in the stock was $30, and GE, you're following it. What is it selling at currently?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, let's say it's, I don't follow the stock individually, but just any stock. Let's just say it's $100. Make it easy. So that would be a $70 capital gain if you sold the stock. And is it a substantial number of shares?
Fairly.
Okay, is it in the thousands of dollars?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it may well be that if this was taxed at your daughter's rate, it is likely, to, if she doesn't have a lot of other income,
no,
that the actual rate that she would be paying on that may be only 10%.
Oh.
on the gain.
Uh-huh.
You'd have to check that out with your accountant, but it could be as low as 10%.
Okay.
Which would not be very, very, frightful, worrisome, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, if you are thinking that you are going to take this GE stock and you are simply going to pour that into an IRA, I think you're going to find you're not going to be able to do that.
Oh.
Okay? You just can't take an asset that you already own and pour it into an IRA. That won't work.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to an IRA company and you're starting and establishing a new IRA, brand spanking new,
mm-hmm.
you're going to establish that with cash and then buy an asset through them.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
So about the best you could do is, well, there are some complicated strategies where you could buy and sell your position within 30 days, but I don't really recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you want to find out is if you are truly interested in diversifying, and I'm a great believer in diversification,
yeah.
and I think you're on the right track with an equity index, maybe even a total market index or two indexes, a large one and a small one to
mm-hmm.
begin with,
mm-hmm.
and you need the cash from GE, I think your accountant may convince you that you're only going to be facing a 10%
yeah.
tax on the gain
mm-hmm.
and using that money then to establish the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would suspect that she's going to establish a Roth IRA.
Right.
Okay. That's a good idea. But what a wonderful thing to have a 14-year-old start a Roth IRA.
Yeah.
And not only does the money grow tax-free, that when you take it out, at least under current law, you're not going to be taxed on it either. And you can also save up for money for a first-time home buying situation where you could take as much as, say, $10,000 out of a Roth IRA, no penalty, use it for a down payment on a home. Lots of advantages to a Roth IRA.
Yes, uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you very much for your advice, and thank WILL for this valuable program.
All right, well, thank you for the call.
Thanks.
We had somebody who asked a question off the air and was just curious whether you were familiar with a book titled The Coming Internet Depression, which apparently has been written by a guy who is an economics editor at Businessweek. And in this book, he, as I'm looking here at what it says on Amazon, in this book it says that he's making the argument that there is an inevitable downturn coming in the internet economy that could drag the rest of the economy down with it. I don't know. Are you familiar with the book, or what do
I'm
you think
really
about that
argument?
I'm
not really familiar with the book. I think the thesis is certainly not unreasonable. I really get concerned when I hear about the doom and gloomers. The doom and gloomers have been out there forever. I've been a perennial optimist. No question that when you're looking at the NASDAQ, you start to wonder even about the Amazon.coms. When in the world are they going to turn a profit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, billion-dollar, even trillion-dollar capitalized companies, when in the world are they going to turn a profit? The day has to come when they turn a profit. And that's a serious problem for internet companies and internet providers to turn a profit on e-commerce, their product, through their advertising, through their billing, whatever. However, when I think about, for example, the NASDAQ 100, in addition to the giant companies, we're really talking about the giant technology companies, the hardware companies, the companies that are actually providing the bells, the whistles, the hardware, if you will, for the internet world. I'm a lot more interested in those kinds of companies, whether it's the Microsofts, the Oracles, the Ciscos. I think those kinds of companies are companies that are going to survive, they're going to prosper, et cetera. I think the major issue for a lot of these companies is the amount of government regulation. Certainly something that has had a major chilling effect on the NASDAQ has been the attempted breakup of Microsoft. And that whole situation remains to be played out. I think that changes dramatically under a Bush administration. Really do. I think that whole thing changes because of the at least Bush vent toward less regulation, especially in the commercial sphere. So I'm a little bit hesitant to go along with doomers and gloomers because, you know, sell a lot of books, but it usually doesn't turn out to be that way. And but certainly we've seen some correction. We continue to see some correction. And it's very, very difficult to invest in companies that have been around for a while and still have yet to turn a profit. I would agree with that part of the thesis.
All right. We're already a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is David Sinno. He's president and CEO of Strategic Capital Bank. He's here monthly on the program. It's always a Friday. We do these shows on personal finance. And if you have questions, you can call us. If you're here in Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. That's for local folks here for Champaign-Urbana. But if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And another caller here, it is in Urbana. They are in Urbana here, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I am running a dog breed rescue program, and I have filed for incorporation and received that. I'm in the process of now filing for charitable status. And I have two related questions. First of all, assuming that I do get the charitable status, somebody told me that the deductions would be retroactive, or that I could treat it as a charitable organization from the date of filing. That's my first question. My second question is, since I spend a great deal of money on this dog rescue program, is it best to dump a large chunk of money into this incorporated group and then have that group essentially purchase the food, et cetera, for the animals? Or can one just as easily buy things like food and heartworm medication, et cetera, and deduct it from your income tax?
Those are very good questions. The first question, and I'm 90% certain, but again, I would suggest that you talk with your accountant or your lawyer who is helping you with this, that generally the charitable status that you've applied for is retroactive to the date of your filing. So
okay.
That would be number one. Because there are a lot of people who may be desirous of donating to your organization but are waiting for your 501 designation.
Right.
When you filed for your 501, under what subparagraph did you file? Did you file a 501C something?
Yes, 501C3.
C3.
Right.
All right. So if you filed for a 501C3, how long ago did you file?
We're just going to file this week.
Oh, you just filed this week.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a good while to find out. You may be anywhere from, as if you were on the fast track, 90 days.
Yeah. No, I understand that. But I'm just trying to understand, once I get that status, what's the best way for me to use that status for my tax deduction purposes? Should I put a chunk of money into the corporation, or should I simply deduct as I purchase food, et cetera, for the animals?
I think it's a lot easier. First of all, whether you receive this status or not, if you're going to have to file as a profitable organization, let's say.
No, it's a nonprofit.
It's a nonprofit, but you certainly... You've already have the nonprofit status.
Yes.
All right. I think it's easier. You may consider, and again, this is a question for your accountant because I'm really not certain of how many dollars we're talking about, the income expense flow. I would think that you might be advised, are these monies coming out of your personal monies?
Yes.
So you're going to be giving these monies. I really think that you might want to loan these monies to the organization as opposed to capitalize the organization, so that you have a way of getting paid back out of this money. And then this money is now sitting in the organization, and you have a note receivable. The organization has a note payable. And, of course, then the organization itself are buying these products. And remember, there may be some sales tax advantages.
Right.
If the organization is buying it as opposed to you're buying it personally. And it clearly would be a necessary and ordinary expense for the corporation. So I think that might be a better mousetrap from what you are telling me. But I would urge you, do you have competent accounting advice?
I sure hope so.
Okay, then rely on that advice.
Okay.
And why don't you see if that idea might make some sense?
So
I'm a little leery of you taking a lot of your personal capital and capitalizing it, putting it into this organization. I prefer that you may, for example, loan the money to this organization.
But if I loan it, can I deduct that from my income tax?
Well, no, you don't deduct the loan. It's just like if you loaned me money. Uh-huh. It's not a deduction from your personal income tax. Wouldn't be a deduction from your personal income tax.
But my whole problem is that I sink, I mean, literally thousands of dollars a year into this, and I'm trying to see if I can't get some tax relief as a consequence.
Well, the way you would get the tax relief, obviously, is that all of the expenses that you sink into this are deductible either personally on a Schedule C, if that's the way you're doing it now, but even if you loan the money to this corporation, the corporation then gets all of the breaks, so there wouldn't be any income tax owing, and you would still have your note receivable. You would still be owed money. I think you ought to go down that route with your accountant and check that out.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on here. The next caller is in Downs, and that would be on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to know what you would do with $20,000 today. We have biggest chunk in sort of a general stock fund. We've got some global, some foreign, some telecom, a high-tech fund. And what would you do with $20,000 today?
Today. Are you willing to commit it long-term to the stock market?
Yeah.
You're a stock market investor.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you represented in large cap value and small cap value positions?
Probably not small cap.
Small cap value?
Yeah.
You're not in that?
No.
Well, that's where I would go.
Okay.
I would go into small cap value. Are you into small cap?
No.
Okay.
That's probably where we're
I think those are the two asset classes that you should be looking at. And of that $20,000, I would have $12,000 of it in small cap value and $8,000 of it in small cap.
Okay.
And I wouldn't even mind if you averaged in over the next 12 months into that position.
What, do you have anything specific?
Well, I think you could go to Vanguard Small Cap Value and Vanguard Small Company.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
All right, very good. And back to Champaign, line number 1. Hello.
Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. Well, now I have a new question. What is the difference between small cap and small cap value?
Well, small cap, the way I think of small cap, is the market, if you take a look at the New York Stock Exchange, the biggest 500 companies are typically called the S&P 500. Those are the big cap. Mm-hmm. Then there is this mid cap. The next 500 companies are kind of called the mid cap companies. Now, the big cap companies, you take a company like General Electric, which is just a huge, huge company. If you multiply the total number of shares outstanding times the current value of that stock, you're talking about billions, if not trillions of dollars of value in a stock. Follow me?
Yeah.
That's a big company. The mid caps are the next 500 after the biggest 500, and then the next 2,000 are called the Russell 2000. Those are some of the smaller companies, but any more, in terms of their market size may be as much as a billion dollars. They used to be a lot smaller. So that's the Russell 2000, and that's typically called the small cap stocks. But they're not so small cap anymore. So when I think of small cap, what I'm really thinking of is what a lot of people refer to as micro cap, or at least maybe the 25 or 30% of the Russell 2000, the smallest ones on the Russell 2000. And the smaller companies on the Russell 2000 may have market size of only $200 to $500 million. That's considered a small company. Now, that's my definition of small company. In addition, small cap value simply says, look, let's look at all of the small companies within some range of market size, and then let's buy the ones that are cheapest, that we view as the cheapest. And cheapest is defined as when we compare the price of a stock to its liquidation value. In other words, if you liquidated a company and you would get a dollar per share for that liquidation, and the company was selling at $2 per share, and another company that you could liquidate and get a dollar, it was selling at $4 per share, then I'd like to buy the company that is only selling at $2 per share, twice its liquidation value, as opposed to a company that's selling at 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 times its liquidation value. So when you hear the term value investor, or a small cap value fund, or even a large cap value fund, what you're referring to is trying to find the companies that are selling on the cheap, within a specific range. That's called a value play. And over long, long periods of time, and I'm talking 15 to 20-year periods of time, typically value strategies outperform just regular strategies, and small-cap value strategies actually outperform large-cap value strategies. So as an asset class, as an area to invest, I certainly would want to have some of my money in small companies and small-cap or small-company value.
I see. Oh, well, thank you. I'm not sure I have 20 years left, but...
Oh, you sound like you do. You have to plan like you do.
One more question, and I don't know if this is a fair question, is you said you were buying, and I was wondering what it is that you're buying now.
Well, we continue to buy institutional asset classes, and as a money manager, the particular asset class funds and indexes that we buy, in order to access those, it takes somewhere between $2.5 and $5 million. So even I, as an individual, am not able to buy those unless I essentially utilize the buying power among all of our clients. But you can really accomplish the same thing by looking at mutual fund companies that have a number of indexes. And again, I don't have an interest in Vanguard, but I think Vanguard does a very, very good job in offering a series of indexes, in fact, including a small cap value fund, a small company fund, a large company fund, a large cap value fund, and even I think their Total International Index is a good fund, as well as their emerging markets. So while you can't do exactly what we're doing, you can get fairly close by buying these passive strategies. In other words, you don't have a manager who's saying, should I buy AT&T today and sell Procter & Gamble? No, I'm just going to own all of them within a specific range. And some of them are going to go up and some of them are going to go down. But over long periods of time, I'm better off holding a larger basket of these companies than owning one or two or three or four or five that could blow up at any point in time. So I think you can go to the Vanguard website or call Vanguard at their 800 information number, and they certainly can give you all kinds of good information on the various asset class or index funds that they offer.
One last question. I noticed as I look at those that the two stocks that do exceedingly well in the indexes are health and energy, and I was wondering if you think that's going to continue.
You know, I don't have an opinion. I think over the next 20 years it will continue. Energy over the next 20 years will be good. But day to day, week to week, month to month, I have no opinion about it. I do think that it's very difficult to buy one or two companies and
simply do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, what you're talking about is a sector fund.
Oh.
You're really not talking about an index fund. You're talking about a sector fund like a Fidelity Energy or a Fidelity Healthcare. That's okay. Just understand the bet you are making that those can be very volatile and they can be hot and they can be just as cold. And if you have a place for it as part of your diversified strategy in your portfolio, that's okay. But once you have it, you got to hold it. You can't. You'll get scared when it starts to drop. So that's my only caution with sector funds.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with David Sinnoh. He's here every month with us to answer your questions about money management. And if you have some thoughts or some concerns or some questions about investing and financial planning, you can give us a call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana and they're on line number 3. Hello.
Hello, yes. I have two questions. One is that where can I find information about all no-load index funds that are offered? And the second is there a no-load fund that invests in the following ratios: 5 to 10% in cash, 20 to 25% in total bond index, and 65 to 70% in total stock index?
Well, those are great questions. I think what you will find with reference to your second question, that Vanguard has life stage portfolios.
Okay.
And the life stage portfolios at Vanguard typically will have similar percentages to what you just asked about.
Okay.
They use some of their index funds. So they have something called moderate, conservative, aggressive, and I think there are four of them as I remember, and maybe either the third or fourth most aggressive sort of fits your asset allocation.
Okay.
And then, of course, I think probably if you search the Morningstar universe, they really track most of the no-load mutual funds.
Okay.
There is a book in the Commerce Library at the University of Illinois. I think it's called the No-Load Index Monitor.
Okay.
And I think you could look up almost every no-load in that as well to get information.
Okay.
But certainly, if you went to the Commerce Library, I'm quite certain that you could look up almost every no-load index fund. Take a look at the Vanguard Life Stage portfolios. Other mutual fund companies now have Life Stage portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is whether you want active managers or passive managers.
Okay.
And if you're into the indexing approach,
uh-huh,
then I think you want to look at Vanguard Life Stage portfolios.
Okay. Okay, and the other question is that basically if I want to get a fee-only advisors, are there any in town here, somewhere in, you know, Urbana-Champaign?
In other words, you want a fee-only advisor who can provide you financial planning and investment advice?
Right.
There are some. The answer is yes. I would look for someone who represents themselves as a certified financial planner and ask whether or not they would visit with you on a fee-only basis, that you are not interested in buying products from them.
Okay.
Check their credentials and make certain that they tell you up front what they charge. A certified financial planner is bound by a series of practice standards and codes of ethics, so they will disclose most of these things up front to you in writing before you choose to retain their services.
Okay. And how much typically one would pay? What kind of percentage?
I would think that you would be in the range of anywhere from $125 to $200 an hour for competent advice.
Okay, $125 to $200 an hour?
Yes.
Okay. And so if I have about $100,000 to invest, that would be a good way to go, you think? Or?
Yes, I think for spending an hour with someone to give you advice, I think that's very intelligent, especially with the kind of money that you're desirous of investing in the market.
Okay.
Makes perfect sense.
Okay. All right, great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. And again to another Urbana person here, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have what I hope is a simple question about treasuries that are held in an IRA account. The question has to do with how money, when it's ultimately withdrawn, is taxed at the state level. Is there, you know, this kind of allowance for the source of the income being in the treasury?
The answer is no. It doesn't matter.
It
doesn't matter whether you're in stocks, bonds, treasuries, municipal bonds, whatever you're in. When that money comes out of a traditional IRA, and I presume you're talking about a traditional IRA, that money is going to be subject to ordinary income tax at your highest marginal federal income tax rate.
Okay.
No question about it.
Yeah, that answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
And the caller really raises a good question, because remember that if you are an investor in direct obligations of the federal government, treasury notes, treasury bonds, treasury bills, or a mutual fund that holds just treasury notes, bonds, and bills, that interest is free from state income tax. Not free from federal income tax. When you buy a treasury instrument, you still pay federal income tax, but you'd be free from state income tax. Therefore, if you were going to buy a one-year treasury or a two-year treasury note that paid 6%, and you are comparing that simple interest rate with a two-year certificate of deposit that may be paid 6.2 or 6.3, one would have to take into consideration the impact on state income tax rates, because certificates of deposit, the interest earned is subject to both federal and state income tax rates. Now, fortunately, in Illinois, we do have a fairly low state income tax rate compared to a lot of other states. So it's not as onerous. It becomes a big issue, however, if you're living in a state where you might be paying 7, 8, 9, 10% state income tax rates. Obviously, though, if you are involved inside an IRA, where that asset is sitting inside an IRA, so long as that asset is inside an IRA, it's totally irrelevant. It grows in a tax-deferred environment. And, of course, in a traditional IRA, when you pull money out, hopefully after age 59 and a half, or maybe even 70 and a half when you're required to pull money out, then it becomes taxed. And it really doesn't matter whether you were sitting in an index, a treasury, a piece of real estate, whatever, whenever you take it out. Something else that people often don't understand about an IRA. Let's say that when you are 70 and a half and you now have to start taking money out of an IRA, maybe you are in a financial instrument that is illiquid, or maybe it's in a stock that you don't really want to sell and take the money out. Generally, your plan administrator or your custodian of your IRA, that's the sponsor of your IRA, especially when it is the case of securities, you might, for example, have them transfer out 25 shares of a stock or 100 shares of the stock. That way you haven't sold the stock. It's just like getting cash, so whatever that fair market value is, but then you have the stock in your hands and your basis in that stock is whatever you paid it out at, maybe a couple $1,000s or $5,000, and then you can still hold the stock if you don't want to sell it.
For a long time, I guess the appeal of treasuries to people would be that they certainly paid a respectable rate of interest.
Yes.
And they were extremely safe. You know, as long as you believe that the U.S. government was not going to collapse,
Your
money was okay. Do treasuries make much sense anymore?
Treasuries have a place in a portfolio, but not so much from an interest rate perspective, but more as a hedge against stocks. In other words, when you look at an asset allocation, if you were allocated this year 70% stocks, 30% fixed income, that 30% fixed income in short-term treasuries, CDs, or whatever fixed income really acted as a wonderful moderating hedge, if you will, against a nasty little stock market. So I looked at fixed income more as a hedge against long-term returns in the stock market and short-term downturns in the stock market. Remember that when you invest in fixed income, you have several risks. Obviously, one you don't have is default risk with the federal government. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. But the biggest one you have is interest rate or inflation rate risk. It's sort of the same thing, consumer risk, and that is that you're going to always be paid back in cheaper dollars. So almost every academic study that I've looked at, in fact, frankly, every academic study that I've looked at suggests that it makes very, very little sense when it comes to fixed income investing to go out beyond 5 years. You just don't get a high enough rate of return for tying your money up for that additional quarter of a percent or half a percent versus the volatility of the instrument in case you have to sell it, and taking into consideration how cheap of dollars you're getting paid back in. The people who buy long-term treasury instruments are typically insurance companies who know exactly what kind of costs they have, what kind of actuarial experience they have, and they offset some of that risk against long-term treasuries. But they're holders of those treasuries. They're not buyers and sellers.
Well, we will have to leave it there. I'm sorry we have a couple of people now calling in, but we're out of time for this time around. But next month, Dave will be back, and we'll do it again. David Sinnoh, President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank. Thank you.
Thanks. It's always fun.